Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And if you have ever envied those people that are the adventurers of life, will travel to different corners of the world, experiencing things that maybe they talk about in the movies, or you'll go, wow, their life is so interesting. They never get bored like I do. Well, let me tell you something. We've got a guest today, Greg Dobbs. And this is a man who is a journalist. Yes, and he is going to be sharing with us what goes on behind the stuff that we see on television, that we will hear about. Where do these reports come from? How are they gotten? What is it like for someone that gets dumped in the middle of no man's land and is supposed to regale us with fascinating information? What do these guys do? What do they do? Well, we're going to find out. And Greg, I heard that chuckle. I'm so delighted that you're with me today. Your book, Life in the Wrong Lane, I met you in New York, and when I got your material, I said, yes, this absolutely is my cup of tea. You've done a phenomenal job of
being able to
put this material together, because when one reads your book, Life in the Wrong Lane, Why Journalists Go In When Everyone Else Wants Out, of course, I think it has something to do with insanity. Maybe it runs in the family. With some of the things that I read, my Lord. Anyway, I really think that it's just great what you were able to do. And I can see why you're a journalist. I mean, this is just something that's a part of you. Now, for those of you listening, Greg is a man who worked at ABC News for 23 years, and he was a producer as well as being a correspondent. And he spent 10 years overseas. He's won 2 International Emmy Awards, and he's currently a correspondent for HDNet Television, and he reports and he puts together documentaries for the program World Report. Greg, when you were born, did someone put you in something and just send you around in a time capsule saying, you know, check out all these places before you grow up? I mean, what happened with you? What made you this incredible adventurer that says, yes, you can drop me in the middle of Iran with 5 billion bullets going off. Yes, I'm happy to do this and take care of my equipment and do all this stuff. What in the world possessed you to go into this line of work?
Well, you've made me laugh several times just during that nice introduction, Donna. And most recently when you said when you were born, I've answered a lot of questions about a lot of things, including life in the wrong lane. Nobody ever preceded a question with when you were born. So I don't know how to answer the question, but I can tell you this. Almost everybody is born with the same curiosity, with the same adrenaline, with the same, you know, yearning perhaps to have a front row seat. Sometimes the only difference between them and me and others who do what I've done for all my adult life is that we get a front row seat whether we want it or not. But I think by and large, people who do what I do want that front row seat. You said earlier, the first time I chuckled, you said maybe you, speaking to listeners, maybe you've envied these people who have such interesting lives. There's an awful lot to envy. I said to you when we spoke off the air before doing this interview on the air, I'm the luckiest guy on earth. I've had the best job in the world, but not everybody would want it because there's a lot not to envy. Because you are going into dangerous places. You're going into places where people are hostile toward you. But you ask, why do you do it? You do it just because it's much more interesting for me than sitting at a desk or standing behind a counter.
Well, I concur, and Indiana Jones doesn't have anything on you. I mean, you've had so many different experiences, but I think that is something that has to be innate within you, because you have this love of chaos. In fact, you say of those men and women that you work with that you thrive on chaos. you thrive on bullets going over your head or something like this, and the adrenaline's going 50 million miles an hour. It's not unlike people that like to become pilots, fighter pilots. There is, you know, there may be the moments of boredom, but man, oh man, when you get those adrenaline drives, it's like, woohoo, here we go, let's go for it. Yeah, let's charge. What are we charging? I haven't a clue, but let's find out after we get there. And I think it's marvelous. I really do, because it's when you're 550 years old, when someone's going to say to you, gee whiz, what did you do in your life? And you can whack them over the head with a cane and say, sit down and let me tell you. And they probably
don't
believe you.
That's why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote the book. Because what I've done with my life, Donna, is not just report news stories that have come and gone, that have long since been reported and forgotten. But rather, it's, you know, I mean, the book itself, Life in the Wrong Lane, is about all the scary things and the stupid things, the dangerous things and the distasteful things, but also the funny and the funky and, you know, sort of unbelievable things that journalists like me experience just getting to the point of reporting the story. So in the last year of 2011, if you watched somebody from Libya, somebody from Egypt, somebody from Iraq or Afghanistan or Somalia or Sudan or any of the other trouble spots, the things I write about are the same things they had to do to get to the point of reporting the story. Most of the interesting experiences aren't in the councils of government or even covering the battlefield, but just getting there and, frankly, eating there and sleeping there. And what do you have to do to survive?
Right. And I think one of the first things I would make sure is I had extra batches of deodorant, because I'm telling you, some of the places I've read about that you've been in, my feminine self would
may,
go.
May I give you some advice? May I give you some advice? If ever you just get to take one thing extra over and above your laptop and, you know, your communications devices, which are the first things we need, not deodorant, toilet paper.
I got you there. Boy, do I have firsthand experience of that.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, you know what I'm talking about. A lot of people don't know what we're talking about, though. I don't know how indecent it would be to tell this quick story, but I once in the, I mean, one of the early trips, and I've made probably 100 trips to the Middle East, but one of the very first trips, it was in Algeria, Northwest Africa. I went into an airport restroom. We'd had a long flight to get there. Went into the restroom. There was no toilet paper. There was a sponge.
Yeah.
You know, they're just different cultural value. So always have some toilet paper sort of wadded up in your back pocket.
Kleenex, whatever you've got.
I don't care. Handkerchief. I've gone through a few handkerchiefs, but that's all we'll talk about.
That's right. No, I totally know what you're talking about. Let's talk about a few of your experiences. You kick off your book with Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And I went through that, and there were times I was laughing so hard because I could just see the visual here. You and a bunch of other guys. This was about the Indians, the government, and the Indians were fighting back after things that went on in the late 1800s. Here we are in a time frame, and this is in 1973, so we're going back a few years here with this. But it was just as if I was there when I was reading this, because this was a big, big thing, and there were a lot of you journalists there.
There were, although a lot in those days was defined differently than a lot is today, because we didn't have the 24-hour cable and satellite news networks, we didn't have the internet, we obviously had fewer journalists, and frankly fewer local TV stations that just had the knowledge and technology to be able to, you know, leave the city and go off and broadcast from the middle of South Dakota, or the southern part of South Dakota. But I'll correct you with one thing. The Indians, it was called the American Indian Movement, and they were protesting not just what had happened back in the 1800s, but what was still happening in the 1900s, some of it of their own making, some of it not of their making. But they were protesting that. They occupied the historic little hamlet, if you could even call it that, of Wounded Knee, where there had been a terrible massacre 100 years earlier.
Right.
And we of the news media got in, and we were there for the better part of three and a half weeks before things, they turned to negotiation and so forth. And you had to sneak in and out. You had to sneak in and out because the FBI and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the United States Marshal Service wanted to keep everybody out of the hamlet. And mind you, this is in the rolling hills of South Dakota in, I think it was March, for God's sake. March in South Dakota, you don't even bother taking a swimsuit. And there are barbed wire, you know, farm and ranch section fences, and you could only go in and out at night because during the day they'd stop you. They didn't just stop Indians for fear that they would add to the numbers and maybe bring in ammunition and arms, but they stopped everybody. So you had to sneak in, and it was miles across the rolling hills, stepping through the snow, bumping into barbed wire. And listen, one night, and I write about this in the book, one night going in with a colleague, I'll just put this succinctly. This is not a story that Walter Cronkite or today Brian Williams would ever be able to tell, but I surrendered to a cow.
Yes, that's what I was going to get to. The sentry that was on duty, you guys couldn't see. You didn't
We saw a profile. We saw a profile.
You saw this profile, and boy, you were apologizing to this profile, and you thought for sure you were dead meat, because the FBI and the other officials, they were all armed, and they would have shot you.
Well, arrested us at the very least. Our goal was more than just not getting shot. It was getting in.
That's
and we
right.
wouldn't have gotten in had we been stopped.
Yes, and then you found out that sentry that you were apologizing to this.
Yeah, I mean, I can still picture. It was a silhouette. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the horn, or whatever you call it, I'm a city boy, you know, looked like the butt of a rifle, a machine gun, a shotgun, something like that. And as we got closer and closer and saying, we're journalists, we're not armed, we're putting our equipment down so you can see us, our hands are in the air, and there was no response. No response, no human response. Maybe a moo that we didn't hear at the time, but when we got close enough, we were surrendering to a cow.
Mm-hmm. Then you have a story about a man, Gary Gilmore, and we have someone of this dispositioning right now that something's going on around about, but this was really something, because this guy was a horrific character. And whenever media gets wind of something, I mean, you guys have to respond really, really fast. And again, these are time frames when the individuals like yourself were working. You didn't have sophisticated technology, and you had to make do with environments. And here you are dealing with the fact that this guy, who was a horrific killer, he pleaded guilty, and then the system went bananas and kept delaying this stuff. Kept delaying it over and over again, and the story about his girlfriend was just phenomenal. Tell us how you got involved with this and how you were able to get the scoop on the story, because it was really a most unique situation.
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that would apply to just about any major national or international story. If you're either lucky or smart enough, and in this case, maybe it was a little of both, to be just about the first national reporter on the scene, you're probably going to make connections with some of the key people in a story, and you're always going to be a step ahead of your competition. Sometimes that would describe me in different parts of the world. Sometimes I was the competition that somebody else was a step ahead of. But in the case of Gary Gilmore, I was based in Chicago. ABC News had a bureau in Chicago. We covered most of the territory of the 48 states from there. And so we got newspapers from all the major cities. And if you had a day in town without being out of town covering a story, you leaf through the papers just to look for interesting stories. That's how, you know, somebody based and living in Chicago knew what was going on in Salt Lake City. And I was going through that paper and saw a little item, probably an inch and a half, pardon me, that said, convicted killer wants to die. And it was about this guy, Gary Gilmore. There had been a moratorium on capital punishment imposed by the United States Supreme Court because of inequalities in sentencing procedures around the country of more than half a decade. And so it turned out that he was the first guy sentenced to die. But what made the case really bizarre in the eyes of many people was he wanted to. I could understand it. He was 36 years old. He had spent, Donna, more than half his life behind bars. He was a juvenile delinquent. So, you know, he knew, now caught and convicted of two terrible murders, very similar in nature, as a matter of fact, that he would never leave prison again. So he said, I'd rather die. And yet there were two organizations in those days, and they aren't the ones these days that try to save the sorry souls of convicted, you know, murderers, but they were the ACLU and the NAACP, sought to save the lives of people convicted of a capital crime. And so they were trying to save his life, and he was saying, get off my back. I don't want you to save my life. I want to go ahead with the execution. I mean, I've had a lot of fascinating and sometimes bizarre experiences, but one of them was standing in the Utah Supreme Court chambers hearing this guy beg to be executed.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the first one on the story, so I always, as I say, got to stay a step ahead. And yes, I met his girlfriend. I actually sort of cornered her when she was leaving the Utah State Prison, which is halfway between Provo and Salt Lake City. And she was heading up to the freeway to hitch a ride, and I caught up with her and said, I'll give you a ride if you'll talk with me. And she said, I won't talk with you, but I'll take the ride. Well, eventually, she succumbed to my request to meet her again tomorrow coming out of the prison where she had just visited Gilmore. She said I could. So I was waiting for her. Instead, an ambulance showed up in front of the prison, and Gilmore had overdosed with pills that she had just given him when I met her the day before.
It's
we chased
incredible.
The ambulance halfway to Salt Lake. We, in those days, ambulances had clear, transparent glass. We could see them doing CPR on Gilmore, trying to save his life so they could kill him a month or two later. And then we turned around and raced down to her place in Provo, and there were cops crawling all over the place, and she had also overdosed. It was a mutual suicide pact.
It's just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah.
And you tell how she, and you're going to have to read the book, folks, to find out how she hid the stuff on her body so that she could get it into him, and how he hid the stuff on his body so that when he was being checked, nobody would find it, and then he was able to do the other. I mean, the facts are many times more bizarre than what you could make up for a sci-fi movie. And I was intrigued how when... you talked about different people in the industry, and one of the persons you mentioned in the book was Geraldo. And he was out on a job that you were doing, and he didn't work for the news division, and people apparently were very concerned about him because he was known as a loose cannon. I'm quoting from your book, and you said after that, some things never change. And I was watching a segment with him this morning, and I thought, gee, I remember reading about this guy.
Well, you know, there are different levels of, I was going to use a word I'm not going to use because I know him. There are different levels of reliability in the news business.
Yes.
And, of course, there are different levels of seriousness in news reporting. And, you know, Geraldo just operates on a different level than some of us.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dramatic. He's very watchable. He's an interesting guy and has done some very good and serious work, I would say primarily earlier in his career. But, you know, listen, I was lucky, as I said before, I had the best job on earth, and I got to operate at a very high level, meaning an audience of tens of millions of people and covering for the last 40 years some of the most important events of our time. Not all of them by any stretch, but many of them. And I can tell you that many or most, probably most of the people with whom I deal, journalists like me, working for print, working for the internet these days, working for broadcast, are equally serious and equally intent on trying to do it right. Do we make mistakes sometimes? Absolutely, we're human. But we try to get it right. We even try, and some Americans won't like hearing this, we even try to keep our personal biases out of our reporting.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes a good journalist. When you can take the facts and not color them to suit your own particular attitudes, to be able to detach and to be able to give information. And you guys sometimes work with a very, very tiny time margin. You might only have a minute to be able to put certain points of information together. And there is so much involved in journalism. And the components of technology have changed since when you were traveling overseas, and a lot of these stories that went on in the 70s and up to our time. But when you look at that, and you look at how the equipment you had to haul around, that just weighed pounds. You had to make, you know, and to pack it up. I mean, I remember seeing various people in airports carrying equipment, especially if they were with TV crews. My gracious, you needed a box car to put all the stuff in, it seemed like. And if they were on a plane, you were concerned about how it was packed because it could be, you know, stomped upon by the gorilla in the luggage system. I mean, you had all of these things going on, so you really had to be savvy, alert, and then you had to be able to move quickly when things started happening. You had to be on a run. You had to be ready to go, and that's what you all did. And you had one... Excuse me, go ahead.
I've never traveled with a camera crew. Sometimes it's a single cameraman these days, sometimes it's a two or even a three-person crew. Never traveled with a crew that wasn't prepared to jump off the plane and run to the story, not literally run on our legs, but race to the story and then come back to the airport a day or two later and collect everything else, meaning they carry with them, as I do in my part of the business, everything you need. You never want to ship... I say that with one exception. There was a terrible explosion in a place called Bantry Bay in southwest Ireland. We were in London. We got a call. We raced to the airport. We were getting on a chartered jet to fly across to Ireland, and the cameraman says, uh-oh. You never like to hear uh-oh in any circumstance, but in this case, I said, what's the uh-oh about? He said, I left the camera. So with that one exception, and you can't do much for television without a camera, with that one exception, they're always ready to get off. But, you know, when we travel overseas, and that's how I spent much of my life, if something goes wrong, you don't have Radio Shack.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a local TV station. You don't have a video production house where you can go rent a tripod or pick up a spare lens or anything like that. You've got to go overseas with virtually duplicates of almost everything you're going to need in case something goes bad. It's not unlike, you know, the space shuttle. They had things in triplicate. I mean, right down to the basics, they had three of just about everything, because if something went wrong, then they had a second one. And if that went wrong, of course, it was life or death if they didn't have another backup.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Egypt. You have a fascinating story about when you were in Cairo. And your one sentence says it's the greatest and the worst of the world's cities. Your wife happened to be there with you on one trip, and her experience was something else. I really was impressed with the way that when you wrote your stories, and I'll digress for just a minute, you have the first part of the chapter on each of your stories with very, very clear information, and this time period, which was a very historical time period, you have information about Egypt being once the cradle of civilization, and they are so far removed from that, and they were that way for thousands of years. And then you bring up the wars against Israel, and you talk about Anwar Sadat, who was a terrorist when he was young, and then ends up becoming a very significant man who wants peace and ends up being killed by a Muslim terrorist because they didn't like his attitude, because he was working with the United States. He really had done a 180-degree shift. I mean, this is history that you're talking about, living actual history from a perspective that I think is so very important. And I got a kick out of your wife's story, because she had to learn how to negotiate in the Middle Eastern way, and she did a pretty good job, even though she had to be more educated in a refined manner about how to be more flexible in negotiation. But there is so much that you bring out about this book. You talk about Mrs. Sadat and how she wanted to enable the women, because expanded birth control was a major problem. There's so much starvation there, so much poverty, and she wanted to introduce birth control. And you said,
and by the way, illiteracy, meaning you know, out in the hinterlands and even in Cairo, you know, women who couldn't even read and had never learned much of anything beyond their survival simply didn't understand how they could make life easier using birth control.
Right. In fact, they, instead of taking it like they were told to take it, they took it rectally, which obviously isn't going to work. But they didn't have the education. And the fact of illiteracy, that is one of the biggest enemies that is of any environment, any culture, because when you're illiterate, no matter what culture you come from, you are going to be dominated by those who are literate, who want to keep you in that level of ignorance so they can manipulate you and take from you, so that you never have a right of individuality at any level at all, male or female, and especially with the women.
Absolutely right. And that's the kind of thing that makes us wonder, how are these countries going to pull themselves out of the quicksand in which they are right now sunk, whether or not there has been an Arab Spring revolution in some and not in others, because because, and it's not unlike Russia, frankly, in a different sense, but there's a parallel. People who have always had leaders, for better or worse, leaders who have been benevolent or otherwise, tell them how to live, suddenly are left to their own devices. It's not easy.
It isn't easy.
You mentioned...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You mentioned
Egypt. Of course, Egypt is still on our radar, as is Libya, and as are a few other places, Syria certainly. But in Egypt, it's an interesting country because it's got a huge population. It can't support everybody, but there's a fairly decent-sized middle class. They're not middle class by our standard, and they're not as big as our middle class as a proportion of the population. But they are people who found a way to live, you know, modern, civilized lives with flush toilets and, you know, all the conveniences. They don't have a boat at the harbor and they don't have a second home, but they are in Egypt's middle class. I have felt confident, and so far my confidence is holding strong, that the future in Egypt will be fairly strong and fairly, I should say, the population and the government will be fairly compatible with American goals for that part of the world. The Muslim Brotherhood, everybody's who's paid any attention anyway, has heard, well, the Muslim Brotherhood constitutes the plurality, if not the majority, of the people there. I knew members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They are not like the Taliban. They're not, you know, they don't want to set the country back 500 years. They want more religious infrastructure, and that's not necessarily compatible with, you know, what we would create there. But at the same time, they know that their entry to the middle class and the relative comfort with which they've lived for the last 20 or 30 years is not thanks exclusively to Allah.
Mm-hmm.
It's thanks to hard work and entrepreneurship and so forth. And that hasn't changed. The people I knew in the Muslim Brotherhood, oh, I still know, you know, these are not people who would have you cover your face in public. They're not people who would deprive you of the right to drive a vehicle. They are not people who would run the country the way the Taliban want to run, for example, or Al-Shabaab want to run Somalia.
It's really fascinating. What I was going to share with you to cover a point you just brought out is the attitudes of people that have been in a positioning in general. The mass of people have been subservient to those that have been the rulers, whoever's been in charge. I did an interview in the 90s with an attorney that was in the upper ranks of the Communist Party in Moscow at the National Academy of Sciences. When I did the interview with him after we were finished, he said to me, "You Americans have a fire of freedom that burns inside of you that is unbelievable. You feel you have the right to be free. We Russians do not feel that way." And my husband and I, after this business trip, when we came back home, we started looking for materials on Russian history. And the very thing that you just said, it is so much a part of the Russian culture, going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, because of various situations of Mongolians invading and who knows else, what else before, there has been that positioning. And to come out of that, to change your attitude, to change your psyche from what has been even genetically passed along, it is just, it's quite phenomenal. It really is. And Greg, I'll tell you, I'm so impressed with this material. And for those of you listening, if you want to absolutely get a grip on your reading seat so that when you're going through this, you'll get the visuals, you'll see it, you'll smell it, you'll feel it. He has given such good information, and you'll get an inside look as to what journalists have to go through today. We've got cell phones today that he didn't have with these stories that he participated in. We have cameras that are very, very small. We have people that are sending and receiving information all over the world now, which has its pluses and minuses. But the reality is, to get in to where you have to go, a good journalist with good integrity is really going to be putting their lives on the line, or lives, honoring all of those that do this, men and women both. It is quite incredible. So when you hear about the death of a journalist or injury or whatever, you need to realize that someone has taken a chance so that they can get information back to home base, wherever that might be, so that we can be informed. and it's not a job to be taken lightly. But wow, what a journey. Greg, what's your website that people can go to find out more about what you do?
Oh, well, it's gregdobbs.net, GREGDOBBS.net. Thanks for asking.
Well, it's my pleasure. Your book, Life in the Wrong Lane, Why Journalists Go In When Everyone Else Wants Out, that's the truth. I just think this is great. I would just love to see young people reading this and understanding how important honest, truthful, honest journalism be enforced. What is the biggest complaint you have about journalism today?
Well, two things. Bias. And it's not an illegitimate complaint. It's just not as widespread, I think, as some charge. And the other is something that I truly believe myself. Things have changed because of the rush to be the first to get something on the air or online or whatever. Things have changed to where it's almost more important to be first than to be right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's wrong. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. It is. So it just means that everyone, absolutely everyone who cares anything about what's happening in their world and in their community or in between, has to become their own best filter and not just accept things blindly, but figure out who seems credible and who doesn't.
I couldn't agree more, and I've heard this from other journalists as well who have become disillusioned with a lot of the protocols, if you can call them that, that are enforced by various environments, and they say that's not the truth. We cannot have this. We've got to have integrity with what we deliver. And my hat's off to all of you who are out there doing this, because there's not very many of us that would volunteer, I'll tell you. it really takes guts, and my hat's off to you a thousandfold.
Have you got time for a quick anecdote?
Sure, go ahead.
Or not. Okay, this will describe people of my ilk. About 6 months maybe ago, a cameraman and I went to Colombia for our program on HDNet World Report. Went to Colombia, spent almost 2 weeks covering the drug war, and it's a real war. It's a real war with big-time weapons and combat helicopters and bad guys who shoot back. And we went down there, and we went on a helicopter raid where we're sitting on the bench where, you know, if the helicopter turns too far to the starboard side, you would just fall out if not for the seatbelt. You know, you're sitting on the outside. And we land, and we run behind some soldiers, and we raid a lab where things are still hot. I mean, the bad guys have just left. All of a sudden, the bad guys are coming back. And we're running back to the helicopter, and another helicopter is providing cover fire. And we get on the helicopter. They don't want us to get hurt, of course, so we're the first ones out of there. And it's so noisy because you're sitting on a bench on the outside of the helicopter that with the whoosh of the rotors, you can't talk. And when we finally land about 20 minutes later at a remote Colombian Army base, the first thing the cameraman says to me is, "I wouldn't trade this for anything." I mean, we were tired, we were dirty, we'd come close to getting shot, we were in a miserable place with a bunch of people we could hardly talk with. He says, "I wouldn't trade this for anything." That's how I feel. That's how everyone mm-hmm. who does it feels. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it.
Absolutely. Well, the life of an adventurer in a context that perhaps you would never expect that of a professional journalist. Greg Dobbs. Hey, go check it out. Go to gregdobbs.net. Life in the Wrong Lane. It is an awesome, awesome book, and I recommend it highly. Greg, thanks so much for being my guest today. I know you've got a busy schedule, and it was a delight having you.
My delight. Thanks to you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a minute. Don't go away. More good things to come.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open. And if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I'd be delighted to do exactly that. Here's the toll-free number for you to call into, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And if you are listening to this broadcast for the first time, all you need to know is I just want you to give me, when you call in, your first name or your initial. Of course, I'd love to know where you're calling in from. And then let me tell you what I perceive. And after that, you can ask me a question about anything that you like. 888-627-6008. I wanted to share with you a delightful poem by William Arthur Ward. I really like this. And this is how it reads. Another fresh new year is here. Another year to live, to banish worry, doubt, and fear, to love, laugh, and give. This bright new year has given me to live each day with zest, to daily grow and try to be my highest and my best. I have the opportunity once more to right some wrongs, to pray for peace, to plant a tree, and sing more joyful songs. William Arthur Ward. Wonderful, wonderful poem, and I thought very appropriate for today. Now, quick like a bunny, I want to remind those of you in Western Washington, 2 major events that I will be participating in. On January the 21st, I am going to be appearing at the Ascension into Light Foundation Center, which is at 1222 South Weller Street. That's 3 2's, 1222 South Weller Street in Seattle. And if you need information on this event, which is going to be starting about 6:30 that evening, a Saturday, 206-356-6356 is the telephone number, 206-356-6356. Or you can check out the newsletter on my website. There's going to be details there. But there are going to be 4 of us that will be available to do readings for people and to help you get started with the new year. So it's going to be a very positive, upbeat event in the evening on January 21st. January 28th, the second Quantum Mind 2, second Quantum Mind class is coming up on January the 28th. We have limited seating. We can only take 25 students in. And Robert Newman, who is a feng shui specialist, is going to be talking about feng shui, a whole different batch of information. And I am going to be doing the second part of the program that day, and we're going to have actual exercises. One of them is going to be blindfolded, which anybody who attends is going to participate in this. It's really a wonderful way to show you how the intuitive processes work. So it's on January the 28th, 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. We will have lunch and a break for that. We're going to have this wonderful interactive workshop for only $59.95 for the day, and we would love to have you come in. Again, if you or a friend want to participate, call my office, 253 1-800-582-5604 or send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com, and reserve your seat. This is a dynamic class. Our first class, Quantum One, was so successful that people said, please, would you do something else? Would you give us this, 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 and this? And a lot of requests were made, and Robert and I are going to, in this class, try to address a lot of the items and issues that people wanted to discuss. And at the first class, of course, we didn't have enough time for that. So anyway, that's coming up. Now, I wanted to share some information with you. And again, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. I'm going to share with you today some of the 10 ways that you can sabotage your own success. Yes. And usually we want to say how we do not sabotage, but Krista is a woman that sent me information. She has been on a number of radio shows, and in the process of doing the show, she found out that there were usually these 10 points that she wanted to cover, so I'll be doing that. I'll be chatting with you about that. But I thought, since I'm in the Pacific Northwest and Seattle is, well, a sister location for me, it is known, renowned, especially in the center there in downtown Seattle, the Space Needle. And I wanted to share some fascinating information about this because this year is the 50th anniversary of the Seattle World's Fair and the completion of the Space Needle. Now, its anniversary is actually in April. Now, here are some points of information on this phenomenal design, which at the time, 50 years ago, when it was done, just was unbelievable to most people. Now, these are numbers that are going to catch your interest. $4.5 million. Now, that's what it cost 50 years ago building the Space Needle. They were so efficient when they were building this that they were able to get it done in under a year, and they were able to stay within their budget. When was the last time you heard of any project with any city staying within a budget? Well, that year it did. Now, today, when they revitalized it, not today, but in 2000, they had to do some work on the Space Needle. Like any building, it will have a deterioration factor. In 2000, the year 2000, it was $20 million. $20 million. And in that process of rejuvenating the Space Needle, they put on a pavilion level space store that they have there, their restaurant, the deck overhaul, and there were a lot of other improvements. Now, it took 8,000 gallons of paint to repaint it. It is 605 feet high from the ground to the top, and of course, that includes the aircraft warning beacon that is on the very top of the building. Yes, they have to have that for safety purposes. And you have 848 steps from the bottom of the basement to the top of the observation deck. Of course, everybody takes the elevator. And then the weight of it is 125 tons. And that is only for the weight in tons of the track and wheel system that allows the Sky City restaurant to revolve on its turntable. So I didn't say that correctly. This is just the turntable. You know, this stuff, 125 tons. And I forget, I don't remember how much tonnage of concrete they had to put in the ground just to put the base of the building in. It's a phenomenal number. And then the horsepower of the motor used to make the turntable of the Space Needle move is 1.5. horsepower. It's an amazing experience. If ever you have a chance to come and visit this magnificent area in the Pacific Northwest, do go to the Space Needle. It is incredible, absolutely wonderful, and the view is phenomenal. And sometimes you have to have reservations, sometimes not. But the restaurant up there, I've been in the restaurant, and it's just a wonderful view, and to see the city, well, it's just breathtakingly gorgeous. All right, and I know we're going on a break pretty quickly, but before we do, I want you to know about the guests we've got coming up next week. Patricia Evans on Monday, Victory Over Verbal Abuse. Tuesday, we have Alan Morris, the rogue aviator. And then Amy Amlers is going to be talking about big fat lies women tell themselves. And then Micah Hanks, Exposed, Uncovered, Declassified, Lost Civilizations, and Secrets of the Past. Great lineup of people. If you want to know who's coming on, go into the show information area. For Donna Sebo, push that button, and bingo, you're going to have all the information pop up for your reviewing pleasure. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to share with you 10 ways to sabotage your success. But if you'd rather talk to me, then give me a call at 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Krista is a woman that really is all about empowering people, but she did something that was a little bit unique. She said she decided she was going to talk to people to make sure that they knew how they could sabotage their own success. And I thought, that's a unique approach. Let's see what she had to say. One of the things we always need to remember is that change is a part of life. So she said her number 10 item is, don't try to change any of your habits. And if you don't, you know, if you don't change anything, you're not going to see much of a change in your life. That's a factor of life. She said, are your habits helping you or hurting you? If you want to make changes in your life, you may need to decide to do something differently. I had bumped into a friend at my local post office when I was dropping some things off this morning, and we were talking about how we were doing different things, and she said, I had to make up my mind. If I wanted to get myself into better physical conditioning, she said, I'm not in bad shape. My health is excellent, basically. But she said, I've really gotten flabby because I've been sitting behind the computer all the time. And she said, I needed to make up my mind that I was going to do something. So she's gone to a gym, and she's signed up for things, and she said, I just have to follow through and do it because my habits have caused me to experience a certain patterning. And I thought, yeah, that's what you have to do. So Krista's point is, if you want to sabotage yourself, don't make any changes. Number 9, we're going backwards here, would live in the past or the future, but never the present. So if you want to sabotage yourself, just ignore what's going on around you right now and live in la-la land or in the, oh, I wish I would have changed something attitude. Because when you constantly go into those spaces of trying to say, well, in the future it's going to be better, I don't need to do anything now, you literally are frozen. You're stagnating. So she said, as long as you think your good is only in the future, you won't be able to be in the present where all the good things happen. And if you don't want to live in the present, you're not going to reach your goals. This is so important. The best time that you have is right now. This is the time to plan, organize, but also to do. And it's just a fact of life. We have to be willing to say, okay, I've got an agenda here, but just not sit and think until the cows come home, expecting that something's going to occur. You must take action. And action begets action begets action. And she said, if you want to sabotage your success, focus only on the outer rewards. Why? You'll never be satisfied if you keep your eyes only on the outer world. Things like a new car, better job, or relationship, don't pay any attention to your inner world, your quest, and you're going to be miserable. Be true to yourself. So don't sabotage yourself. Look at really what is going on. Be grateful for what you have. It's so important. And she said, if you want to sabotage yourself, feel as guilty as possible about everything. Oh, boy, that's a biggie. There are so many things in life that we all, I don't know if anybody that's exempt from this, we've made mistakes. We've sometimes made horrific mistakes, sometimes little itsy-bitsy mistakes. Regardless, we all make them. But you use them as leverage. That's what you do. You don't want to defeat yourself. I had someone tell me just the other day, I have this friend that is really telling me whenever I start spouting about, oh, woe is me stuff, she'd say, okay, I've got your permission. Pay attention to what you're saying. Pull yourself out of this. And they're right. Be impatient if you want to sabotage yourself. If you're always in a hurry and you think that everything should be done instantaneously, well, you're just going to rush, and you may find that you rush into nothingness. So you need to remember that there's sometimes a necessity for being impatient, but usually not. Patience is something that works for you, not against you. Doesn't mean you don't do. It means that you allow for life's flow. Fearing change is one of the biggest ways. That was number 5 on our list of sabotaging yourself. You say, oh, I have to wait until everything's absolutely perfect. You're never going to get there. You'll just stay in the same stagnant mess you're in. So you want to be sure that you don't let fear rule you. We're all going to get scared. But courage is when you act regardless of the fear that you might have in your gut. That's right. And number 4, she said, worry about what other people think of you. I like what Terry Cole Whitaker said so many years ago. What other people think about me is none of my business. And I think that that's so true. I don't know where she got that statement from, but it's really true. If you are going to constantly worry about what other people think, you're always going to be in a mediocre level about yourself because you're not being true to who you are. You're being true to what you think other people want you to do. So learning how to be true to yourself is a process, but it's one that once you are comfortable in your own skin, so to speak, you're going to be one happy person. And don't plan on how to do whatever it is you say you want to do. That was her sabotage item number 3. And if you want to be successful, you have to take time to think. You have to take time to plan. You have to be aware that there sometimes is a process you're going to go through. Just flying by the seat of your pants won't do it. So sometimes that might work, but most of the time it won't. And then number 2 is make excuses for why you can't succeed. Oh boy, isn't that a big one? We can blame the dog, the cat, the weather, the tree, the bird, the frog, whatever we want to do, the significant other. And, oh, this is all the reason I'm too poor, I'm too rich, I'm too whatever. Look, you have to be willing to acknowledge your own level of personal responsibility in your life, and that empowers you as an individual. Don't worry about not making it in the time frame you want. Sometimes it comes about in the most unusual ways. You don't know what's going to open up for you. And then, of course, her number 1 sabotaging yourself is to do nothing. How many people have you known that will whine and talk about how bad the world is, and they go on and on and on? Every time you meet them, they have the same script. And their lives are meaningless. Their lives are just empty. But it's always someone else's fault or something else. Look, this is your life. You live it. This is your opportunity to be the best of who you want to be. And that is what living is all about. Life happens sometimes, and sometimes it stinks in the process. But remember, you're the one that has dominance over your actions, your mind, your attitudes. It is so significant. Don't ever give that up to anybody else. Don't ever turn your life over to someone else and say, here, you take it. Whatever you say is what I'll do. Don't do it. Your mind, you belong to yourself. You're a part of this magnificent experience of life. And I think it's your responsibility and your duty to be the best you possibly can be. And maybe you'll walk a different road just like Greg Dobbs has done. Oh, wow. The stories you'll be able to share. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back with you, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Have a magnificent day or evening, wherever you are. Live it to the hilt. This is the best time of your life. Donna Sebo, bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.